Malcolm Honlein's with us. It's time for the weekly update, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM and the AM.
Thank you, Nachum. Good to be with you.
Say a little hoarse. So we're going to excuse you for that. After all, you know, even the greatest of orators do have these episodes where their voices are not at 100%. Lo aleinu, as we say. Anyway, look, I am not in any way looking to give an ayin hara, as the expression goes, and thank God, relatively speaking, because we know what's happening up north and we know what's happening with terror attacks that are happening with regularity. We know all that and it's awful. However, the threat from Iran that has been escalated, the threat, forget about the actual act, the threat has been escalated. It's going to happen now. It's going to happen today. It's going to happen tomorrow. It's going to happen Tisha B'Av. Here's what they plan. Here's what they're going to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously until now, that has not come to fruition. Do you think this is, frankly, an exaggerated hoax of a threat?
No, I think the threat remains. I think, if anything, they're negotiating the threat. There is a lot of resistance in Iran amongst the people to an attack because they know the price they'll pay. And supposedly the new president, though he has really no power, was arguing against a tough retaliation, which has nothing to do with Hezbollah's retaliation. They could do it independently if the decision is made. And today, Hezbollah put out videos showing tunnels with missiles in them ready to launch. So the infrastructure in the north that faces Israel is far greater, perhaps 10 times greater, 5 times greater than that in the south, that what they faced with Hamas, just in the numbers of 150,000, 160,000 missiles, many with precision guidance systems, in addition to the drones, and they proved proficient in the use of armed drones, and to the infrastructure of tunnels, which they've been working on for decades. The whole of Israel's north on the Lebanese side, in Lebanon South, is a whole duplicate of society underneath ground where there are tunnel networks that extend for a huge distance, and they have been training and are working on this. Well, we don't know yet a lot of the other capabilities. So number one, with Iran, you can never tell what the truth is. You know, there were reports that the United States gave secret information to the agents who carried out the assassination of Khania. You know, there are every day other reports that prove to be fallacious. It's part of the game they're playing. Their cyber warfare right now is as dangerous as a military confrontation, but they're expanding it. The banks in Iran, and including the central bank, was hit by a huge cyber war. And now people are saying they may have done it themselves to preempt people running on the banks, and so that they could close them for several days because of the financial situation, which I think, although a rumor, is plausible. To get to the point of your question,
and they use the heat.
Everything remains on the table.
And they had used the heat wave as an excuse to actually close the banks, right?
Well, they may, but yeah, Friday, anyway.
I think that's what they did. I think they used actually the weather as an excuse to shut things down. So, look, before the Hania episode, before those assassinations, you'd have to assume then Israel was on the same type of high alert, hopefully, as they are today. In other words, this threat that we just described and that you analyzed for us is essentially a daily threat that continues, and it's the reality of life as Israel in the Middle East. And if we're going to sit here and try to predict what day or hour anything's going to start from Iran, it's impossible to do that.
And that's part of the game that they're playing, is they want the people of Israel, it's psychological warfare, they want them to be on edge all the time. And I talk to people who are some of the most resolute people in Israel, and you can hear in their voices the frustration, the tension. I spoke to one who lived in the north, military person, great analyst, and she said that 3 o'clock in the morning she would wake up her kids because there was a drone in her neighborhood. And she said, you know, there comes a point where it's very hard to to sustain. And this is part of the game and why we have to do everything we can to show and support the people in Israel, that those who are planning trips should really consider it. I know that the airlines are not flying and it's much more difficult to get there, but I hope that for Yontif, people don't cancel, depending, of course, on the circumstances. But I think we have to do all we can to show support and stand with Israel. The negotiations in Qatar are going on, and they seem to be making some progress. But unless there is this message of real toughness, which Israel has communicated and demonstrated to the Iranians, you know, they attacked an American base in Iraq. There were American through the militias, in Iraqi militias, they attacked the American facility in Syria. If they don't see a strong and consequential response, then they will just take this as a sign of weakness and to be exploited. The one countermeasure measure is the fact that the USS Georgia pulled in, that you have the aircraft carrier with its carrier group, that they, you know, we have a nuclear submarine with 180 Tomahawks on it, that these new capacities in the Red Sea and in the Mediterranean, that's a strong message. That's the kind of thing that can, you know, set them back on their heels, depending upon what they're planning.
It's untied to you, and you mentioned Qatar. I'm not going to try to dig it out now, but I took a screenshot yesterday, literally, of two reports that came in within 30 seconds of each other. One of them saying tremendous progress is being made, and it looks like there's a deal, and the final details have to be worked out. And the next thing, literally 20 seconds later, an official in Egypt has announced that talks have broken down, and there's no hope at the moment for any type of hostage or ceasefire deal. It's almost, I don't want to say it's comical, because I get it. These are sensitive negotiations that really do turn on a dime constantly. But there is some humor to it that, you know, 1 minute to the next, you have no idea what's happening in these negotiations.
And I'm afraid that the people there don't know from 1 minute to the next. But the negotiations are still going on. The contacts and besides, anybody can leak information, as is commonly the case in the Middle East, and it gets picked up right away as facts and gets reported, especially right. If it's something critical of Israel.
Good
or
point.
to increase the pressure right. on Israel. But Israel has limits too. I mean, there is another group that just was formed to oppose any kind of open-ended deal. You know, there are a lot of people who now are renegotiating the Gilad Shalit deal and talk about, you know, the price that was paid and how the recidivists, even you have guys who were released in the first exchange in this war who were killed in carrying out terrorist attacks this week.
Wow.
So you know, but there's so much, there's a thing a minute going on, and, you know, the situation in Iran itself is very clouded. The Zarif, the former foreign minister who was appointed a vice president in charge of strategic something or the other affairs, resigned 2 days later, and supposedly over internal differences about responding. So even in Iran, you can have some internal differences and discussions, and they don't live long to tell about it. But it's just such an overload of information. And we saw Hezbollah now has the ability to swarm drones, meaning you can send over whole batches. I remember once I was at the Israel Independence Day, I was sitting next to Prime Minister Netanyahu when they did the overflight, you know, of those small drones that move around and form pictures and,
sure, right.
and messages.
Right.
And he looked up and he said to me, "Do you know how dangerous that is?" And I said, "I didn't even think of it, that once you can manipulate and move drones, small drones, that they could come and swarm an area and just drop bombs or explode, be self-exploding. And the degree to which you can control it, obviously for Israel, poses immense danger because the borders all around are vulnerable."
Oh.
I mean, it's just stuff that you don't necessarily, we would not necessarily think about. I think Hezbollah's already fired 7,500 rockets, and that's in addition to the drones and everything else. You think about that. Think if the United States had been hit by 7,500 rockets, where would it be? Where would the American people be? And the, you know, you look at the Houthis. We've bombed them 500 times. We've hit their drones, and we still haven't put them out of commission. They're nothing. And that message gets around in the Middle East and say, listen, the Houthis in the poorest country in the world, what Israel did at the port was the strongest message, and they still can't recover from it.
Yeah. The government officials who are so critical of Israel, United States government officials who are so critical of Israel, I would love to play for them, the veteran government officials, I'd love to play for them their reaction to 9/11 and remind them what their attitude was toward the enemy when New York and Washington and Pennsylvania were attacked. And if they would hold Israel to the same to that same standard, Israel would have a much easier time dealing with the world's criticism if they had the United States officials completely on their side. But as you said, you know, if there were 7,500 rockets being shot into the United States, obviously leaders here would act a lot differently and react a lot differently than the way they expect Israel to react. By the way, speaking of Iran, just for a moment, parenthetically, one of our listeners had asked on the app if you have any update about Arvin Netanel Ben Sonia Tziona. To remind the audience, this is the 20-year-old Iranian young man who's being held, sentenced to death, but of course that has been at the minimum postponed. Have you heard anything in the last couple of weeks?
I'm on top of it every day. I can't discuss it, obviously, on the air. It's very, very, very sensitive, clearly. The fact is that the deadline ran out on Rosh Chodesh, because there's a month in which they don't execute, and they go by the lunar calendar also. But there are efforts underway. There are people who are claiming to do efforts that I don't know that they're real, but I can tell you that there are real efforts, and people are extending themselves. We have to save his life. It's a false charge. Hopefully they will review it and make it self-defense or do something so that, you know, because even a long sentence in a prison in Iran is a death sentence for a young Jewish boy. And, you know, the case was that he had lent money to this guy, and when he went to collect it, the guy pulled out a knife and was attacking him, and he grabbed it and stabbed the guy. Right. So it was really, by every definition, self-defense. And there, you know, there's a lot of obstinacy, and the more sometimes public this becomes, if it becomes too much of a Jewish, let alone perceived as Israel issue, it'll make it much more difficult. So hopefully the efforts and people should be mispala for him.
And while we're still discussing Iran, again, one of those news items that seems to switch constantly, maybe not minute to minute, but the debate or the observation about Iran's nuclear capability today. So I'll just give you a couple of quotes. One, this report says Iran has not yet launched work required to manufacture a nuclear weapon. Tony Blinken, our Secretary of State, said at the end of July, the amount of time needed to produce enough weapons-grade material for a nuclear weapon has not yet been attained. What is the reality? For those of us who fear that Iran has an actual nuclear bomb, what is the reality today?
The reality is that they have the components. You know that for how many years have we talked about this? 15 years? Yep. When everybody said it was crazy, when people, administration, were denying it, and in those administrations. And I kept saying, look, we know. It's not questionable. We know. And we knew then certain basic facts. We knew what the IAEA knew from people in the International Atomic Energy Agency. And it was being manipulated, and they got them not to issue sanctions. And in the last round, the United States held back the Europeans from introducing sanctions against Iran on the nuclear program. We know that there are several components. You know, you have to enrich uranium. They're enriching now faster and faster to a higher degree. It's at least 60%, probably even 80%. 90% is weapons grade. So it's only a question, you know, take a week longer to get to enrich to the higher level. The estimate is that in they could have 13 bombs in 3 months. They could have a bomb in 2 weeks. That it's a question of putting the pieces together. So one is getting enriched uranium. Two is being able to fashion it into a bomb. Three is putting the bomb on a missile. And four is having the missile to deliver it. They have the missiles. You saw the ballistic missiles that were fired at Israel. They right. demonstrated that they have that capacity. Yeah. We know that they're working on the weaponization. So they may not have assembled a bomb yet, but they have the components. And all of this is deep underground. So when people say to me, why don't they just go bomb? And they would just, even with bunker buster bombs, it would be complicated. If you had an operation like in Khania with people there, like seems to have taken place in earlier events in Iran, that's one possibility. But you know, they have taken a lot of precautions. They have underground bases for their drones. They have developed their drone capacity and their missile capacity, sending missiles to Russia to use in Ukraine, which is, you know, quite ridiculous when you think about it. But they're dependent on Iran now for it. And in addition, Iran sells Russia's sanctioned oil and makes a lot of money on it, which is why we should be shutting down all their oil export capacity. And they're selling 85% of it to China. And so their income went from $100,000 a day 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Now it's $3.1 million. And every 5 days, they've taken another $1 billion. And that enables them to do a lot of the mischief that they're doing. The people don't benefit from it.
Unbelievable. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored digital radio. Around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com and the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course, the beloved NSN app. Malcolm Honlein's with us. It's weekly update time on this Erev Shabbos Nachamu. There are rumors flying that the Prime Minister of Israel will speak at the UN during the General Assembly next month. I thought that with the UN's current attitude toward the Prime Minister of Israel, there'd be no way they would invite him to speak. What's the update on that?
Well, it's not an invitation because it's mandated. Every country at the opening of the General Assembly is invited to have their head of state, their foreign minister, somebody come and speak. And usually heads of state get first preference, then foreign ministers, then when the ambassadors, if nobody came, then the ambassadors speak. So everybody, all of the members of the UN, I think about 197 or something, all get to speak. And the Prime Minister indicated this week that he would come because it is a platform to lay out, you know, his vision and to hold the UN to account. I thought Ambassador Don's perhaps farewell speech at the UN Security Council was amazing, where he laid out the truth about the UN's hypocrisy, not only double, triple, quadruple standards when it comes to Israel, and the failure to stand up. I don't think they still issued a condemnation just of the attack. It's always conditioned. And, you know, they continued to promulgate the lies, even though UNRWA was exposed, even UNRWA firing 9 people. What about the hundreds more, maybe thousands? And the fact that they have 30,000 employees serving the population, more than serve all the refugees in the rest of the world. It's all ripoff. And it funds the building of the tunnels, and it funds all this other stuff because they were getting hundreds of millions of dollars a month to PA and to Gaza and the West Bank leadership, all of whom become billionaires and 100 millionaires because of it.
The General Assembly begins Tuesday afternoon, September the 10th. Who takes over for Gilad Erdan?
Danny Danone.
And a couple
he was the ambassador, and he's coming back.
Which is good news. And a couple other things happening on this side of the world. What do you think of the timing and eventuality of the resignation of the president of Columbia University?
Well, the timing is always good when you resign. It may have been a little later than
well. It just took her a while to follow the lead of her colleagues, which I found interesting.
Right, and I think that message should never be diminished, or people should understand how important that message is. The you know, we can all talk about competence, and we're not in a position to measure all that stuff. What was clear is that the rulings in the courts that you can't block Jewish students' access to buildings, which is being fought, the suits across the country, California, New York, et cetera, we're going to have many more. It's time. Jews are fighting back. And, you know, we've seen studies that show that 70% of the students on campus do not support the demonstrations and the cause. Now, we know that they're planning major assaults in September, right, after the Democratic National Convention, where they're going to plan, they're bringing tens of thousands of people there. And we can expect that it'll be a very active season on campus. We have to be there for the students. I just saw a note that Ramaz, for the first time since its history and was founded in 1937, has no students applying to Columbia.
Wow.
And the Jewish population in many of the universities is dropping precipitously because of imposed quotas, not public, but existing, you know, real quotas.
Right.
And because students are looking for places that are considered safe, where they're not going to be harassed on the campus, and the fact is that in New York, it's becoming harder and harder to find a place like that. Not in the city universities, not at NYU, not at Columbia.
Right.
And I hope that everybody will help the students to respond to the needs of students in locus parentis, that, you know, where they don't have families, that they know that they can turn to the community. We are working on new security arrangements with the campuses across the country. There are really activist groups that are doing great things, training students. The leadership that's emerging from this is very encouraging. Students who are really just so articulate, who stand up, who can go in the media, who can go anywhere and make the case, go before members of Congress. And I took students from 20 universities with Olami to meet senators, and senators were crying when they finished. And each one had 1 minute just to tell what happened to them.
Wow.
When a girl gets up and says, my dorm door was set on fire on a Friday night, and the university did nothing but offer her mental health counseling. And a student was put in the hospital. Anyway, the answer is that we're going to see much more of this. We are finding out things. We're going to have a much more activist response. There are all sorts of new initiatives that are being started by lay people and by students that are really wonderful. And I think some will be public, some are not public. But I think that the response will be much more robust.
Would you agree that her successor will have a difficult job?
Very difficult job. I think that interim person is from the medical school. I don't know anybody would want to take it in a time like this. But obviously it's very prestigious, and the right person would be welcomed by us for if they can do it. But
I wonder if they would go out of their way to appoint a Jew as president.
I think the appointment should be religious and color blind. It should be just the best person who can handle I'm saying sometimes appointing a Jew can be to our detriment.
Right. No, I hear that as well, 100%. And you mentioned the convention. And you mentioned what's happening in terms of the plans for the college campuses after the convention. What do you expect next week in Chicago? Is it going to be a very violent scene? Usually, and we've seen recently this has not been the case, but usually when major police forces are prepared, things go relatively well and are quieter than they could be. What do you anticipate for next week?
I believe, like Wisconsin, really prepared at the RNC, so the demonstrators were kept far away, there were no clashes or minimum presence. Here, they're not pro-Palestinian, the pro-Hamas group has been given the right to march right near the convention center, and the pro-Israel group that applied for a thing was not given permission, and I think only yesterday they may have been given a permit for an area after there was a big stink and a lot of protests, but they were turning down the Jewish students, yet they gave them the right, and they gave them 1 mile to march, and they said it's not enough because we're bringing tens of thousands. They demanded 2 miles. I don't know if that has been resolved, but clearly they are planning, and they write in their internal literature that this will they make the references to the 1968 Democratic Convention, which of course was very violent and protest was very strong, and that they're planning and have been talking about that for months already, that that's their objective and the model that they've adopted. Right. So I think you can anticipate that there will be clashes. I think the police certainly have had enough time to prepare, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of federal enforcement as well there. And we'll just have to see. You know, it only takes one or two to turn something into a bloody situation.
And you're not dismissing the fact that the inside of the convention could be affected as well. Like you just said, it could take one or two, one violent act or sneaking in one type of weapon. And God forbid, you know, who knows what could happen. So we're not dismissing what could happen inside, but the outside certainly looks like it's going to be very active.
I think, you know, people remember once when we did the Soviet Tree and Gerald Ford was there and President Ford, others in Madison Square Garden, and two or three people started yelling about one of the speakers. Right. And you can hear it throughout the whole stadium.
Right.
And, you know, in an indoor stadium, you start screaming something and you have a few people do it. You can do it. You can disrupt an event.
They're very similar to what happened to Kamala last week.
And get a chant going. Exactly. So, you know, it doesn't, again, you're absolutely right. They can infiltrate people. They do it. They got into the hotel where the prime minister was staying in Washington with all the secret services.
I cannot believe we have not heard any details or no news source has gone nuts about that whole operation. It was so disgraceful, so damaging, affected so many people. And we saw it, you know, as a small news item, you know, for 10 minutes.
And it was such a disgusting display, right. You know, bringing maggots in. So I was there, and I have to tell you, we had to go through magnetometers. They checked everybody. There was a lot of Secret Service, a lot of Washington police there. The hotel itself has a single entrance. So what they must have done is that they rented rooms, probably checked in 5 or 6 days before, right. Kept the rooms, were able to bring in the stuff that they did. But already the night before, they set off fire alarms the whole night. And you know, there are cameras on floors. People, they should be able to have detected who did this. And then they did it the next night, the even more vicious and disgusting attacks with maggots, with stuff bringing into the hotel. And the question is, how did they do that? And how come nobody's been held to account for it?
Unbelievable. Got to get your opinion about what's happening now in Russia. Ukraine obviously has utilized the last few days to create a real offensive, take prisoners of war, etc. I mean, with this war becoming more of a stalemate, and I think back to other wars where we were glad to an extent, not that anyone's ever glad a war is taking place, but we're glad to an extent that the attention of the world was in a different direction. Now that this war is clearly more of a stalemate than it was months ago, is this a good thing? Does it mean there's potential for a quicker end to the Ukraine-Russia war? How do you view it?
Well, one has to really give the Ukrainians credit for this very bold and up now successful move. It's very embarrassing for Putin.
Right.
They have responded, but they've not been effective in countering it and rooting it out. And the question is, are they going to hold the territory and use it for trading? Are they going to withdraw to their border and say, you know, we created the victory we wanted? Are they going to leave? Are they going to use it as a base for further action? You know, the more extended the lines become, the more difficult it is to supply and to support. So in terms of the propaganda message, they won. They got that across. I think people in Russia, this is such a huge embarrassment. I mean, I hear it from people and for Putin himself. And the question is why they have not been able to mobilize the forces that will, you know, to bring them there, because Ukraine is likely to strike in any place that they withdraw forces from. They're likely to hit there, too.
Right.
So, yes, this is very consequential, but I don't see the evidence yet that this is going to hasten a settlement. A lot of people are dying. A lot of people are suffering from it. And, you know, it's a huge drain on both. When Iran has to supply the missiles and you don't know what trades Russia is making with Iran to get their support and to sustain their support, and the growing coalition of North Korea, China, Russia, Iran, which we've warned about here for a long time. And now all of a sudden people are starting to pay attention to this coalescence and what it could mean. And, you know, the growth of the BRICS, the fact that the petrodollar is not being used. There's so many things, and it gets shunted aside in terms of public attention because the media doesn't highlight it. Maybe they don't even understand it. But these are consequential changes. And we will have to see how Russia emerges from this. And does it become more aggressive? You know, there was always talk that they would hit Lithuania or Latvia or other countries as well if they got away with it with Ukraine. Well, they're not getting away with it with Ukraine so far.
Right. I just wonder if Ukraine continues to force Russia to be more dug in into this war, if it takes Russia's attention away from its intentions of what it wants to do with Iran, Syria, etc., which obviously is always detrimental to Israel. I don't know if it matters, but I just, you know, wonder if it does divert attention, because as you just described, Putin has got to be obsessed with this now because of what it's doing for his reputation and his world image.
Of course, yes. It's and you saw that Abbas was meeting with Putin this week. Oh, right. That the Russian foreign minister and others were in. The head of the army was in Iran, was in Tehran. I mean, they're still trying to play the role. But I think that it's people are reassessing all of these relationships. And the more dependent they become on outside powers, on outside relationships, then the more complicated it becomes. And it can Iran then manipulate them against Israel to promote their Islamist ideology and agenda? That's a really serious consideration.
Malcolm, did Pakistan give ballistic missiles to Iran? And I ask this question because we do pay attention to the ancillary, and I get it, no country there is ancillary, but we do pay attention to what India and Turkey, we discussed Turkey last week, and now a country like Pakistan are doing in regard to which side they're on. Is it true they gave missiles to Iran?
So you remember IQ Khan, who was the Pakistani guy in charge, who did sell their nuclear technology. We do believe at the time that they had a deal with Saudi Arabia, not with Iran. Iran is getting its missile and other information from North Korea. They have a synergistic relationship. And whenever there's like a nuclear explosion in Iran, North Koreans are there. When North Korea launches a ballistic missile, Iran is there. Iran's missiles are based on the Nodong from North Korea. So I'd say North Korea is a primary a supplier and partner for them. But Russia also could be, you know, when they're so desperate and to get the assistance and the aid that they need, that Russia could provide them. And of course, Pakistan has proven through with the exercise of IQ Khan to be a supplier as well.
Finally, Yoav Gallant and Bibi Netanyahu are never going to agree on the direction of this current war, correct?
I guess they, you know, they should realize that their fates are intertwined. Yeah, the fact that they're fighting publicly and that we have this kind of disagreement, that cannot help. And they, you know, if people lose faith in their government and as this drags on, obviously it tests people's attitude. I think Israelis have great resolve. They're still great heroes. The fighters are amazing. The resilience after 300 days, there are guys who have literally been 200 to 300 days in Gaza. I mean, if you think about it, it's amazing. Yep. And yet they only talk about going back and about sustaining the effort, that they believe it's important. They've had a lot of successes in the last couple of days, both in Gaza, especially in Gaza, discovering tunnels, killing a lot of terrorists, and don't believe reports when they bombed that building, it killed 19 terrorists, and they're claiming 90 and 100, go to 1,000 people were killed. Again, it's all exaggerated numbers, and today, I don't know if you saw this week, Australia did experts did a study of the World Kitchen, World Central Kitchens, remember?
That episode, sure.
You remember? And it got the whole world condemning because they killed right. 8 workers. And they came out and they said, no, Israel was completely vindicated, that there were terrorists who got onto these cars, and these are all cleared. And then they saw that this wasn't what they had cleared, so they thought it was Hamas guys, because they were in the cars with them. And this is not Jewish, this is not anything pro-Israel. This was an independent exercise, and they came out this week and said Israel's vindicated in the attack.
Yeah.
You saw a headline in the New York Times? You saw the Wall Street Journal? Anybody? Anybody? No.
Of course not. Well, a refor shlema to you, Mr. Honlein. If you'd like some of my listeners' recipes for recovery that I've gotten over the last 40 years, I'll forward them to you. Some do include a whole bunch of peach brandy and chocolate syrup and a whole bunch of other stuff. I don't know if you're interested.
I don't. Do any of them have cholent in it?
By the way, there's no doubt. There's no doubt at least one of them has a hefty dose of cholent, that I can guarantee you. Have a wonderful Shabbos Nachamu, and we will speak, please God, next week.
Jake, be well, good job.
Malcolm Honlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations, weekly update, we call it, on a Friday morning, about 8:40 each Friday right here at JM in the AM.